Hello, this is Brent Clough. I'm pleased to bring you a special recording made on my recent trip to the island of Anaphoria and to the village of Nabu Kongul, where I helped to set up the first radio station there. During my stay, I was able to record the great storyteller, Banaf Shu. This is the first time Banaf Shu has granted such an opportunity for anyone outside her village to hear the oldest and most sacred of the Anaphorian myths. Here is Banaf Shu, as recorded on June 25th of last year.
The very existence of our people, who owe their origins to these myths, is our proof that these myths are true. But as we know, not all myths are true. Take the ones that are told about our land from the outside, for example. These are not true, and perhaps say more about the tellers than of us. So I am speaking here to dispel the fabrications about our land. They speak as if Anaphoria is some sort of utopia without its own conflicts and struggles. Yes, we are proud and prefer our existence in these humble abodes, but we too share the human condition that, like most, encompasses our failures and entails conflicts that we must overcome. Only 2 evenings ago, our square was filled with commotion once again, just as it is every year at this time. But I should not tell this part of our story before it occurs. We all know of our origin. Our origin begins with our oldest legends, when Anaphoria, like now, consisted of many different people with different languages. We all share what is known island-wide as the Tangumu, or the legend of the three frivolous battles. The world began as our primal spider goddess, Aonan, spinning on her celestial spinning wheel, created the cosmos with her great, harmonious and intertwined web. But her abilities caused three of her rival deities, Cerdo, Seant, and Belili, to be overcome with jealousy, and together they conspired to steal or at least destroy her wheel. In their attempt, it was her friends, Mapesa and Chapalu, who helped hold these assailants at bay, though not shielding the axis of the wheel from all damage. To this day, the wheel spins off kilter, something we humans can only observe through generations, what you non-Anaphorians call the precession of the equinoxes. This was by no means the end of trouble in the cosmos, brought forth by Aonan's rivals. While Cerdo fled due to his injuries, Seant and Belili recouped from their wounds, only to ferment their jealousies. Dumdau is of such immense size and weight, it is barely capable of movement, for it consumes all in its path, leaving whole areas of the sky an empty vacuum. We can see where the stars have been stolen and consumed by this creature, helped across the heavens by Seant and Belili. It is this path we see blackened in the Milky Way. We can see that not every star fell to their efforts. Some of these stars, known only as the 108 stars of orientation, are endowed with special powers to retain the celestial alignment. These special ones each have an intelligence or being that guides its neighboring stars to perpetuate the primal spinning. Without them, the galactic web of the spider goddess Aonan would disperse in all directions and lose its form. When Seant and Belili pursued one of the most important of these stars and its intelligence, a great chase ensued, circling the heavens 9 times before the star, which they could not capture, was shattered. It was one of the greatest novas of all time, and the beings before us tell how even in the daylight it could be seen. Still, the intelligence survived intact and, being quite a trickster, freed from the star, moved even swifter than before. In no time, Seyont and Belili, the dim-witted pair, found themselves lost and confused, surrounded in a labyrinth of nebula. The more they attempted to escape, the more they strayed away from the remnants of this star. Aonan now needed help to gather up every last bit of star matter, even those that were no bigger than pollen. Without haste, she recruited her uncle Monok, who was the great starsmith. Monok worked relentlessly, pounding away, and throughout the universe there was the resounding of his work that still echoes back to us today. These fragments became a mighty new star we know as the Sun. Watching over this operation, her friends, Mapesa and Chapalu, collected the shards and sparks, and Aonan, now in her beetle form, rolled these into the balls we call Earth and our neighbouring planets. It was our Earth that Aonan decided to enter for the time, seeing in it a good home and shelter. She knew it would only be a matter of time before Seyont and Belili would return. So Aonan took this time to sleep, and she dreamed for the first time. She became quite fond of what she dreamt, and it was not without consequence. This was when the first humans stirred beneath the surface. They were the most intelligent of the four-limbed ones, but still lacked the eight limbs of its creator, much less the wings of her friends. The Celestials found great pleasure in the humans, and especially their humor. They were not alone either, as there was another race of beings made of a subtler substance than matter, who, while not quite guides of these humans, had an attachment that is still not understood. To keep both of them safe, Aonan prepared for them 43 sanctuaries and 67 groves. Near one of these, on the banks of our river So'ara, from an opening in the earth, humans arose. They were followed by great gusts of steam that gave us our clouds, and as this moisture became plentiful, it filled the opening with a brilliant yellow water of extreme heat. As the water cooled, one human who tried to go back through the hole lost his life, not realizing it contained some sort of corrosive. The humans kept their distance from this ever-changing yellow pool, and instead used the nearby river So'ara as their source of water. One day, a family was relaxing downstream when the pool overflowed its banks into the river without notice. Their infant child watched as yellow strands flowed in front of him and put his hand in the water. He licked his thumb before his parents, rushing up to him, could stop him. Instantly, he fell over stiff as the parents screamed, convinced their child was dead. They could do nothing more than wrap and take the child back to their house, where as the news travelled, the roar of anguish first filled the village and then the whole valley. It was next afternoon, when all had gathered, that the child began to stir once again, immediately filling the parents with joy, but also frightening many others. The child arose and began to speak of what it had seen, and wanted to know the meaning of the colours surrounding people's heads. The fearful amongst the villagers whispered that an evil demon had entered the child's body, which was why he could now speak as never before and was trying to fool them. Some of the villagers got together and planned to kill the child and his family. Their plot was overheard by a cousin, and she warned the parents what was about to take place that very night. The mother made bundles in each bed as a disguise, to make it appear that the family was asleep. And as an artisan of dyes, she filled the bundle in the child's bed with a yellow dye that matched the colour of the pool. After sunset and into the moonless night, they quickly escaped toward the slopes of Mount Meru. The parents beheld in their minds what they had been warned would happen. Villagers surrounding the cabin, blocking the doors and windows, lighting it on fire and drowning out the cries of those inside with the sound of large drums. As if by design, they stopped and looked down toward the village, where they saw a flame of yellow shooting high into the sky. The band of assassins was convinced that all had been killed. Barely hours after, a strange moaning could be heard coming from the river that lasted throughout the night and into morning, when it was found coming from the pool. Those that understood said the voice was crying a great mistake had been made and that they would no longer be able to live there. So each day the level of the river became lower and lower, and after the fifth day was completely dry, except for a scattered puddle ringed with signs of evaporation. The people left and were forced further and further away and would be forever lost. These people became the Macha people, and eventually they left the island. But we will speak of them later. In the weeks after the escape, the child adopted the name of Gojotha and continued to learn to speak, not only human words, but also the languages of many animals. It was especially the birds with whom he spoke, the parrots even choosing him to be a part of their high council. They developed an alphabet that included the tracks of animals, the star patterns of orientation, and the sequence of signs of our island cycles, which together formed a calendar. Gojo, as he was now called, did not notice how the years passed, as he did little else but perfect this with his friends, and he forgot about all other humans outside his own parents. In the years that came, the climate improved, and crops were good and could be stored away. Then humans again appeared in the valleys and would ascend the two mountain peaks of the island on pilgrimages. Many would venture up Mount Meru, the higher of the two peaks, alone, then more often in pairs or complete families. It became common for small bands of pilgrims to converse with Gojo. People who had been to the other mountain, Mount Namayasa, told him of a holy woman who lived there and seemed to echo his knowledge. As these seekers increased, they joined others who came and settled in the former village, as if attracted by some unknown force. The river too began to appear once again, first as a brook, and eventually in its former fullness. The pool had cooled and was now a warm, gentle green well that softly overflowed, its sides spilling into the river. No one knew of the pool's former corrosive nature, but still they were hesitant. Again, it intermittently spoke to a few. Those who heard were still the ones who could see colours around the heads of others. Not always did the pool draw villagers' attention to matters of importance. Sometimes it merely wanted to chat and hear the trifles of the village. Gojotha felt an urge now for the company of other humans. While he had shared his knowledge in an unassuming way with those that visited him, his remoteness and his talents caused some to worship him. So he felt if he no longer remained aloof, they would realize he was just as human. His gifts were strong and could do much good in the village, but there were still things he could not do and he wished to learn. So he told his parents that he wanted to return to the village, as surely all danger had long since passed from anyone's memories, including his own. His parents had grown older and felt no inclination one way or the other to return, so they remained behind for the time being, maybe to come later, maybe not. Gojotha, the young adult, promised to visit them and bring them the luxuries that only the village could bestow. He would not enter the village empty-handed, though, so as a gift, he assembled some of his favourite treasures of beauty, gentleness, and power, and placed these within his blanket, weaved of the strongest thread. Before it was rolled up, his mother placed the last handful of dye that she had used years before to save the family. Neither was surprised to find it had turned to an indigo colour. As he descended the mountain with the roll beneath his arm, a never-ending stream of indigo fell behind him, marking to this day the line of our northernmost path. He entered the main market of the village to be greeted by a woman named Majura. She too was carrying a similar roll, with a trail of turquoise, orange, and russet behind her. As they talked, Gojotha discovered that her family had left in disgust immediately after the other villagers had set fire to his family's house. He also discovered that Majura was the daughter of the cousin who had warned his family. She told him of how they had ended up on the far side of the island, around Mount Namayasa. But as more and more people appeared from their former village, her family moved to a higher plateau to avoid them. Here the family developed the process of growing the 17 plants and grains together. It was this method that would eventually bring such abundance to the whole island of Anaphoria. Majura disclosed how her favourite thing to do was to scamper up the slopes around the peak of the mysterious mountain. Her excursions became more and more frequent once she found the holy woman there. It was only after much convincing by her that Majura now returned to the village. Gojotha shared how he had lived on Mount Meru and had also brought gifts in a roll just as she did. He was surprised to find that they walked a path that weaved a spiral of 3.5 turns that arrived at the centre of the village market. This is where Gojotha and Majura exchanged their roles. You can see just here where I stand. The wise new leaders of the village refused to accept the roles as gifts, saying that surely the forces that guided them had meant the exchange to be between the pair. Gojotha and Majura became inseparable, and they were married next to the pool. It is said that at the ceremony, some heard the pool speak, while others who heard nothing were bewildered by the long periods of silence. Gojotha and Majura had 14 children, half of them female and half male, and as they grew, the village experienced its greatest period of prosperity. However, as the couple aged, there was an unspoken sadness as they all knew that their days were coming to an end. So one day, the elderly Gojotha and Majura did what nobody had ever done. They both entered the pool, laughing as they had often done in their early years. As their youngest child watched, they dived over and over again, surfacing with great smiles and glowing as the pool glistened. At one moment, they both dived down together and disappeared. The child ran to tell the villagers what had happened. For days, people from all around would come and visit the pool to pay tribute and watch as the water changed from the colours of their rolls to every colour imaginable. For generations, Gojotha and Majura's roles remained where they left them. They were the pride of the village. But as time passed, people forgot how they came to be there. Their story eroded over generations, and many considered them little more than fable. At times, their story would experience a resurgence amongst the villagers, and the pool would stir and talk to the rare person or two who could understand. But its language became more and more archaic, and harder for even those gifted ones to understand. It was during the last revival that the town square was built to enclose the spiral that remains the centre of our village to this day. Over time, no one noticed as the descendants of the 14 children meandered further and further from the village until all trace of them disappeared, as did the tale of Gojotha and Majura. With this, the village descended into hardship. Things were still worse for the Macha, the original descendants of the village, who had attempted to kill the child and his family. While they had remained together, they too lost all memory of the village. As they buried the shame of their past, they had become worse in their ways. Instead of growing the 17 grains and plants, they took up weapons and chose a path of destruction and thievery to survive. It was a painful life, not only for their victims, but for themselves also, as such ways bring no joy. They moved away from Anaphoria, conquering people on neighboring islands. They cared nothing for the place where they once lived, and in little time lost all connection with Anaphoria. Eventually, the Macha began to attack their former island. It is from this time that the legend of the bell ringer emerges. He would appear on the outskirts of villages in single parade, signaling his enigmatic patterns. Nobody was sure if he was human or a spirit, as he would talk to no one and would appear and disappear without a trace. Somehow, mysteriously, everybody could understand the messages contained in the ringing of his bell. Thanks to him, village after village was saved from surprise attacks by the Macha. Aonan, the cosmic spider, still slept within our earth, but she found her dreams to be more and more interrupted. Maybe this is what caused these events on the surface. Or perhaps it was their action that affected her. It is hard to tell. But again, there was a shift in the cosmos. Serdo had found his way back and broke the bounds that mesmerized Seont and Belili, and once again they had the strength of three. To continue their struggle, they realized they should shift their battle from the cosmos to planet Earth. They found the Macha people to their liking and transfigured themselves to be one of them, or should I say three of them. They discussed with the more experienced Macha warriors how the bell ringer had foiled every attempt at surprise upon the Anaphorian villages. Before the next attack, Serdo took it upon himself to create a barrier around the bell ringer, who remained unaware that his bell could not be heard. Over the next month, village after village fell and was routed by the cruel Macha. It was our village that became the refuge for those who had managed to escape to congregate. The Macha advanced upon the last remaining people of Anaphoria in our village. It was in Gojotha and Majura's square that the forces met, and as their dust rose in its many colours, many of the attackers lost their lives. It was the first time the Macha were driven back and tasted defeat. The Macha had not expected this, so had not sent the full strength of their forces. This defeat so infuriated Serdo that Seont and Belili began to assemble the largest force they had ever assembled. Within weeks, the Macha were snickering as they sailed over a waveless plateau of a sea, which Seont had leveled with his magic, while Belili conjured the benefit of strong winds. Landing tip to tip on the shore as far as the eye could see, these lustful attackers moved toward the village. There was much crying and moaning as they surrounded the village, awaiting its last moments. The eve of this attack, however, brought Aonan a dream. In this dream, the bell ringer appeared on the edge of the river, where the wrathful trio mocked him by making him watch the slaughter to come. They took turns pushing him about and into the river to keep him soaked. Without thinking, Sodo gleefully pushed him into the pool, only to see a great luminous spout carry the bell ringer upward with an enormous bell and striker, high above any barrier Sodo had thought to make. The bell ringer did not hesitate for a moment and grabbed the striker and hit the bell. Even if this was Aonan's dream, she was now awakened, and her stirring, or the sound of the bell, or both, caused the land to shake. From all over the isle, the ghosts of the fallen and even their ancestors appeared and attacked the Macha warriors, who were filled with fear, for they knew not how to fight such phantoms. They fled to their boats, only to find the sea echoing with the reverberation of the bell, or the stirrings of Aonan, which engulfed the sea in great waves that we must assume destroyed all that was left of the Macha. No one knows, for there was none who lived to tell. We know only that they never returned to Anaphoria, nor to their adopted island. We understand that their surviving descendants who remained on that island have now also taken up the 17 grains and plants, but still, for the shame of their ancestors, have not had any direct contact with those of us on Anaphoria. Meanwhile, the pool is now the colour indigo, and those who can hear, tell us of the laughter of Gojo and Majura.